Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. In today's program, we're going to be talking about small business owners converting their businesses into worker co-ops. We're going to talk about strikes, longshoremen on the West Coast. Their strike is over. UPS, their strike is on the agenda. We're going to talk about class struggles all over the place in the United States as a reminder that they're never not present. They may be below the surface, and if so, they're bubbling to get to the top, as we will look at. And in the second half of today's program, we will be interviewing a frequent guest, Chris Hedges, in terms of how he sees the evolutionary situation here in the United States right now. So let's get right to it. I begin with a story that was published in the Boston Globe, the number one newspaper in the state of Massachusetts, and indeed in much of New England. On the 14th of June, a reporter named Dana Gerber told a story that is old but has some new twists. Here's the old part. As our population ages, there are tens of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses whose owners built them up usually from modest beginnings, but are now interested in retiring and wondering what to do with their business that has 20 workers or 50 workers or 200 workers that they've gathered as their business has grown. And they confront a really bad choice. They could shut their business down, but they worked a lifetime to build it up. They don't want to. Moreover, it would be catastrophic for all those employees, many of whom they know by name, having hired them. They don't want to do it. They could sell out to another company, but that runs the same risk. The new company could shut the business down, fire the workers, replace them with others, close it down, etc. They don't want to go on and become a share company, issue shares on the stock market, again, for the same reason. And they discover, by eliminating everything else, that there's one thing they can do that meets more of their needs. Sell the business to the workers in it. They won't close it down because it's their business. It's their job. The community will help because it doesn't want the business to close. It doesn't want the workers to lose their jobs. It's bad for the whole community. Wow, a basis for better community based on worker co-op businesses is a better solution to older people retiring off of their capitalist businesses than anything else available. And then Dana Gerber points out that the state of Massachusetts has just passed some legislation to enable and facilitate this conversion of capitalist businesses into worker co-ops for the benefit of the workers and the community. In other words, this is a way of showing that capitalism is not the best thing for a society. Something else is. Now, why do I say this? Because here's the basis for a whole new politics in America, a politics of worker co-ops, together with a political party, a party for the co-ops, which is busy getting the state to help co-ops grow, to help co-ops replace capitalist enterprises for the security of the jobs, for the benefit of the communities. The co-ops could be the base of such a political party, giving it the votes and the funds to function. And the party could win rules, regulations, and laws that help these co-ops to grow. Out of that relationship, a whole new politics could develop here in the United States. And you know what it would look like? The politics of an earlier time in America, when capitalism was fighting against old landed interests, feudal landlords, here in the U.S. as well. And they used the government to help capitalism grow out of the shell of the old system. Well, that's what the worker co-ops can do. Build a political party or help do it that will make the transition easier, quicker for these co-ops. They need technical help. They need better laws. They need capital. Just this week, I read about the U.S. government making a $9 billion loan to the Ford Motor Company at below market interest rates. The Ford Motor Company can pay market interest rates. It's one of the biggest, richest companies in the world. Why is the government subsidizing them? And that's the same government that is nickel and diming food stamp recipients, making them work more hours to get their food stamp. Who gets subsidized? Who gets penalized? I want to shout out to the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union on the West Coast. They struck the West Coast ports earlier this year. They did it after having waited almost a year while the companies didn't come across in negotiations. The old contract had expired a year ago, July 2022. And here we are coming on July 2023. Well, when they stopped talking and stopped the business from happening, wow, everything changed. They got a new contract. The strike is over. It's a six-year contract, but it goes back retroactive to last year, so it's the last year plus 5 years. The workers got, ready, 32% increase in their salary across this six-year contract. So I want to celebrate. That's a lot more than most other working people have been able to get or are likely to get. And it's because this union has a long history of walking off the job. When they sit down with the employer knows you don't come across to a reasonable compromise, we will strike you, and then you won't get any profit at all. They tried them, they tested them, they went on strike, 32%. While it's an amazing victory and an amazing achievement to get a 32% increase in your salary, let's be clear. If we have the same rate of inflation over the next 6 years, 5% a year, that we currently have, this 32% will mean they can't afford to buy any more 6 years from now with 32% more than they can buy right now. The inflation will eat up, and that's a better deal than most Americans are getting. You want to move the working class ahead, which is what the working class wants, you have to get more than 32%. And that means you have to be willing to fight. Well, that segues neatly into the fact that on August 1st of this year, the contract of the United Parcel Service workers, almost 350,000 of them, expires, and they have voted 97% to go on strike if their needs are not met. So far, UPS has not only not met their needs, but insulted their intelligence. I'm going to give you the example of how that worked. The UPS, thinking they could fool the workers, their own employees, announced that they were concerned about the health and well-being of their drivers, which, no doubt, news to the drivers. And here's how they're going to show it. They are going, they said, to install air conditioners in those big brown vans the UPS workers drive. So first of all, let's understand. Their commitment to health and safety is new. For the previous years, during the heat of summers, there was no air conditioning. The company was so cheap, so disregarding of the health and safety of their workers that they didn't put air conditioning. Now they're proposing to do it, and they want everyone to applaud. They actually expected the union to roll over and accept crappy wages because they got something now that they should have got 20 years ago. You know what this is? This is called class struggle. Withholding air conditioners from your workers, that's a cheap way to make more profit at the expense of people. Forcing the longshoremen out on a strike where they earn no money for themselves and their families, that's the class struggle between employers and employees. Here's another story that just surfaced. In case you missed this one, it is so illustrative of the class struggle everywhere that I couldn't not tell you about it. In Northern California, there's a restaurant. I won't mention its name, but if you write to me, I will be glad to tell you. And here's what they got caught doing. And remember, those who get caught are usually a very small fraction of those who are doing whatever this guy got caught for. This employer hired an actor to pretend to be a priest, a religious priest, who offered to take confessions from the workers at this enterprise, and then ratted out what those workers told this fake priest to the employer. The employer had also been caught recently for not paying back wages owed to workers. He had not paid for overtime. He had paid managers bonuses out of the employees' tip pool. I mean, it doesn't stop. This is all class struggle. This employer behaves that way because he makes more profit by squeezing his workers legally and clearly illegally. Employers everywhere do that. The class struggle that we're not supposed to talk about, that teachers are afraid to teach about, that doesn't appear in most newspaper articles. That's what's going on. That's the class struggle that is part of our daily lives. And it costs us. Because remember, the stories I tell you are the ones that get in to the news. Most of them are suppressed and repressed by employers who don't want you to know how ruthlessly most of them are driven, not by their personal needs, but by their position in society. Your company survives if you get high profits. If you don't, you're going to lose the competition. So you have to squeeze your workers. It's nothing personal, you know. It's just business. My last update that we'll have time for has to do with a little town facing a big problem. The name of the town, Seaford. Seaford, Delaware. The people of Seaford, Delaware are now demanding and are likely to get from the legislature in Delaware the right to let corporations vote. This is very important, folks. All around Delaware, there are communities that have already done this. The vote can be by a person, you, me, man, woman, child, but also in these communities, a company, a partnership, a corporation can also vote. They recently, in one Delaware town, caught a fellow who set up 33 different businesses in a community and voted 33 times in an election. Not satisfied with buying politicians, with donations, bribes, paying for the lobbyists who do what the elected official is supposed to be doing. Not content with controlling politics that way, corporate America now wants to join you in having its own votes. In Seaford, the latest vote they had 340 people. It's a small town. You know how many businesses are registered in Seaford? 234. They would control nearly half the election. And you know what they could do? Elect the kind of politician who's even more serving of the corporations than the ones we elect. There is no limit to what corporations are doing so long as we permit them to do it. We've come to the end of the first half of today's economic update. I hope you found these updates interesting. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our guest, Chris Hedges. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. It is with great pleasure that I bring to our microphones and our cameras Chris Hedges. He really needs no introduction, both because he's been on this program and because he makes himself available on so many platforms around the country and beyond the United States. But I will summarize that he is one of the foremost journalists in the United States, a Pulitzer Prize winner, worked with the New York Times and many other quite prestigious outposts of journalism, more or less. He has a program called Chris Hedges Report, a podcast. Welcome, Chris. Very glad to be with you again.
Thanks, Rick.
All right. I have some questions here. We're not bound by them, but I want to ask them, and they reflect a good bit of the emails and other communications coming in to us. So let me begin. Is the gap between mainstream media, leading academics, corporate and government spokespersons on our social reality here in the United States, is the gap between that and what the average person experiences and believes growing? In other words, in your judgment, is the so-called disconnect that it often is referred to, is that real? And if so, what do you think about it?
Well, not only is it real, but let's say roughly 60% of American families are living paycheck to paycheck. They don't have $400 or $1,000. I don't remember the exact figure. I'm sure you do, for an emergency. They are trapped in the instability of the gig economy. So there's not job protection. Even if they have some kind of health insurance, it's the mercenary for-profit form of health insurance, which really doesn't cover catastrophic illnesses. And of course, if you get a catastrophic illness, you can't afford to pay your premiums, which means you lose it. That's why over a million people a year go bankrupt, even though they have insurance. So there is a deep distress rippling through the American population, and it's been rendered invisible by a corporate media that doesn't report it. I mean, look closely at the model, what the model for what goes as journalism now on CNN, MSNBC, any of these networks. It's just chatting about a few main headlines, and the shows will talk exactly the same kind of list of items will leap from show to show. Almost no reporting at all, and certainly no reporting of those that their advertisers and the corporate executives know will essentially create images or give voice to those the corporate state doesn't want to hold up. So you've rendered invisible over half the population. You don't do any reporting anymore. It's completely partisan. The media has been siloed. One side, Fox News, of course, is cheerleading the Republican Party. On the other, CNN and MSNBC. And their credibility, I think it's even lower than Congress. So the media system in the United States, which has been seized by corporate power, and that's part of what the deregulation of the FCC under Bill Clinton achieved, is farce. It's burlesque. And I'm old enough to have started as a journalist in the 1980s in Central America and watched the very steep deterioration that's taken place within, with all of its flaws. I mean, I don't want to pretend those flaws weren't there, but the deterioration is so marked as to be really, I think it's fair to say, certainly on the airwaves, they don't do journalism anymore, at least the commercial outlets. And then you have these alternative nonprofit, Your Show and others, that attempt to address serious issues, but are marginalized. This is what the Twitter files expose, that the Homeland Security, the FBI, the State Department, the Pentagon were having weekly meetings with these social media platforms, as Matt Taibbi exposed when Elon Musk let him into the Twitter accounts, the back and forth, and all this stuff has disappeared. Critics from the left, critics from the right. And then I just want one final point, and that is that when we talk about the Democratic Party, it is really now composed of the old establishment Republican Party, Liz Cheney, Crystal, all these figures have essentially been incorporated into the Democratic Party. And what they are opposing is Trump's white man's party. And I don't want to minimize the danger that a new Trump administration would visit, but both the media landscape and the political landscape is collapsed. You know more about Weimar than I do, but it certainly looks very much like the end of Weimar when you have these ineffectual established politicians, Bruning and others, with no support. Look at Biden and the rise of these kind of, in the case of Germany, fascist, but here kind of proto-Christian fascist movement. So people talk about, I, as you know, worked with Ralph Nader, talk about third parties as being spoilers. And no, the fact is the inability on the part of the ruling class, both the establishment Republican Party and the Democratic Party, to address in any serious way the distress of the majority of the citizens within the country is propelling us, as it always happens, as it did in Yugoslavia, I covered that war, towards an authoritarian system.
How do you, given all of that, how do you understand the basis for the fact that literally for 30 to 40 years, the gap between rich and poor in this country has widened to a point that people back in the 50s and 60s really thought, and a large majority of them, could never happen again. Now it has happened. Why is it acceptable to the extent that it is?
It's not acceptable. Good. It's just that the working class has been disempowered. So in the 50s, certainly in the early 50s, you had what, 34% plus of workers were organized into labor unions. And so there has been such a concerted, starting with the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, but such a concerted effort to break the back of unions, to destroy unions. Now we have about 11%, and I think about 6%, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and these figures are public sector. And we saw with the railroad, the freight workers, they don't have the ability to strike. That was taken from them by Biden and the Congress under the Railroad Act. And you had the Democratic Party under Biden, when they were running, positioning themselves as a kind of pro-labor party, and they would strengthen collective bargaining. And then when threatened with a strike, they took away the ability to collectively bargain among one of the few organized unions that had it. So people are angry, and it is being expressed in very dark ways, especially by the white working class, but they're not organized. And it is the destruction of unions that I think is at the core of both our political and economic malaise. And so you have an enraged population that has no ability to pit power against power, because the only ability that the workers have to pit power against power is the strike. And that is, in essence, been taken from them. I mean, strikes, God, they're in all, you know, are virtually illegal in the United States.
Do you see some hope in the militancy, at least in a few areas, Amazon, Starbucks? Do you see something shifting in the working class, in a sense, in response to what you've just said?
Well, certainly the aspirations are there. But remember, organizations, corporations like Amazon, Starbucks, Walmarts are really vicious in terms of breaking any kind of nascent unionized movement or union drive. And even when you establish a union, as they did in Long Island with Amazon, there's heavy pressure to destroy it. So yes, the aspirations are there, and that is where the hope is. That's why Shama Sawant is not running for re-election on the city council in Seattle, but trying to build nationally a worker strike back movement. Because of course, the other problem is that the union leadership of the unions that exist, the old AFL-CIO, et cetera, have really been bought off with lavish salaries. They're just kind of junior partners in the capitalist system. So many of these strikes really have to become wildcat strikes where they defy the union leadership. I think it was 2018, the West Virginia teacher strike, where the union leadership didn't want to strike and the teachers struck on their own. But we're almost beginning from zero. And so, yes, there's certainly hope, but we can't be naive about all of the forces, both governmental, but also corporate, that will attempt to break the back of this movement. And we are a product of probably the bloodiest labor wars in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers were killed. Tens of thousands were blacklisted. And these people will play dirty and they'll play hard to break the back, because they have essentially succeeded in domesticating the working class, and they want to keep it that way, especially with the gig economy. No, even I just was part of the strike at Rutgers, because I teach as an adjunct in the prison system. There you have people with PhDs earning $28,000 a year without benefits, and they can't even afford rent. I mean, some of them are sleeping on couches or friends. And the highest paid state official in New Jersey is the Rutgers football coach at $4 million a year. I mean, just insane. So you have a corporate kind of model. I mean, they even professors now have been plunged into the temp or gig economy with no benefits and no job security. So we have a steep hill to climb. But yes, I find hope in that there is an understanding among the working class that this is the only way out, both economically and politically.
Let me shift the focus, but I don't think it's unrelated. What do you think of the argument that the rise of China, the rise of the BRICS, basically the wars lost in Afghanistan, Vietnam, Iraq, and so on, that there is a decline of the American empire, as before the British empire had its decline, as every empire has had its decline? Do you see such a thing happening? And if so, what is its possible interaction with the description inside the United States you just made?
Yeah, well, we are declining, following the same trajectory as every empire that is in its dying iteration. I studied classics, so that was true with Greece and Rome, the Ottoman Empire. I mean, they consume themselves in the end. They engage in military adventurism that is self-defeating. That's how the Athenian Empire, when they invaded Sicily, was destroyed. And that's how you got at the end of the Roman Empire, the Praetorian Guard auctioning off the seat of emperor. So yeah, I mean, if you read Tainter or any of these other anthropologists who study Ronald Wright, I mean, all of these figures have chronicled the decline of empire, Jared Diamond and others. It's always the same, Redding, and we've ticked off that list. So what you do is essentially seek through military means to regain a lost hegemony, but it doesn't work. It's self-defeating. And that's what, if you look at the 20 years of futile war that we just carried out in the Middle East, that's an example of that. So you respond to the rise of new empires, new centers of power like China with military force. And what it does is, of course, drain the country of its own resources, our public transportation, everything's a mess. So yes, we are completely following that trajectory.
Chris, as always with you, it's always going so fast, but I will bring you back. You are very kind to come on the program. Our audience is growing, and it has for years now, in part because of contributions you make. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm sorry to have to come to the end of it, but you will be back. And I can say to my audience that I look forward, as always, to speaking with you again next week.